available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Ashley Haywood, to this week's Outlook, which is being recorded on Wednesday, the 4th of March, 2026. Today, we hear about training the animals that feature in all creatures great and small. We visit Radway on the edge of the Cotswolds and learn about rocks, Winnie the Pooh, and what it's like to live on the land. We're also given some really useful tips on travelling around. All of that, as well as sport, your postbag, and an update on developments here at the Hub. But first, we have the week's local news, read today by Nigel and Elaine.
Outlook News.
The decision has been made and the budget for the upcoming year has been set. Residents in the city are set to pay 3.9% more in council tax after proposals were voted through at a full council meeting last week. That increase just affects the City Council's share of the council tax, which makes up most of the total bill. The Police and Crime Commissioner for the West Midlands has increased its preset by 6.5% this year, while the West Midlands Fire Authority has increased their share by 6.2%. The total increase, therefore, on the whole council tax bill is 4.3%. There's also additional charges for those who live in Orsley, Finham and Kersley areas, as these have parish councils, which also charge an additional preset. The annual bill for council tax, excluding any parish council charges in Coventry, will range from a band A at £1,677 to a band H at £5,032. There are discounts if you live alone or if a resident of the house is disabled or is on low income or in receipt of benefits. Full exemptions also apply for student halls or student households and some other categories. After allowing for all discounts and exemptions, Coventry City Council says the average council tax bill is £1,603.
Unemployment in Warwickshire has slightly exceeded the national average, according to the most recent regional figures, with experts predicting a worsening situation. Data presented to Warwickshire County Council's Communities Overview and Scrutiny Committee this week revealed that unemployment has risen from 4.2% to 4.4% between June and September 25 last year. This September figure was marginally higher than the national average of 4.3%, and whilst it compared favourably with the West Midlands figure of 5.4%, a report from the County Council's Head of Economy and Skills, Isabel Woods, warned of troubling signs ahead. She pointed to a perfect storm of declining unemployment levels, increased redundancies and reduced hiring nationally that is expected to feed into Warwickshire's data as more up-to-date local figures are released, pushing our rate higher in the coming months. The report adds, young people are likely to be hit hardest, as under-25s already experience the highest unemployment and benefit claimant rates, both locally and nationally. Nationally, payrolled employees have fallen by 134,000 year-on-year, with redundancies 20% higher at the end of 2025. Vacancy rates have dropped in the past 3 months, but remain slightly up on this time last year. Ms. Woods told the scrutiny panel, there is a mixture of elements at play. We are seeing employers being more cautious, we are seeing inflation and interest rates, rising costs, and we are seeing uncertainty across markets. There are fewer vacancies when people are leaving work. There is also increased competition, which is starting to affect graduates and apprenticeships. There are positives with the County Council continuing to aid employers with things such as sustainable energy grants and business support, and it is reported that interest in inward investment is up. Councillor Matecki said, it is not good news to see unemployment going up, but encouragingly, it is not anything this county is doing wrong.
A major new £50 million fund to assist automotive companies in the West Midlands secure new contracts and generate jobs in the electric vehicle sector is being established. Businesses will be able to apply to the West Midlands Supplier Readiness and Transformation Fund for grants to invest in new equipment, skills and production capacity to help them compete in the expanding EV market. From April, grants of between £250,000 and £3 million will be available, with at least 50% private match funding required. As a result of the match funding requirement, the programme could see a total of £100 million being invested. West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker said he secured £50 million for the fund from the government as part of his plan to keep the region's motor industry at the forefront of the transition to electrification. The fund will run for 4 years and forms part of the government's Drive 35 initiative, which aims to strengthen UK supply chains and boost domestic production as the country moves towards zero emission technologies. The West Midlands boasts one of the UK's largest automotive sectors, with 1,000 companies employing more than 30,000 people, making cars, engineering parts, and developing state-of-the-art EV and battery technology. It is hoped the fund will boost capacity in the supply chain and put the region in pole position to help meet the rapidly growing demand for electric vehicles, creating more skilled local jobs, boosting wages and productivity. Mr. Parker said, "We are the birthplace of the UK car industry, and now, more than 100 years after petrol cars first rolled off the Daimler production line in Coventry, we are powering towards a new era of electrification. Government is backing our flair for car building and innovation, because it knows a successful West Midlands automotive sector is crucial to the wider British economy. This funding is good news and will help us write a bright new chapter in our car industry's long and proud story. Major investment is already being made in the sector, including £23 million for the Coventry and Warwick Investment Zone site, ready for battery manufacturing. 10,000 publicly accessible EV charging connection points and a rollout of a zero-emission bus fleet."
Despite our recent gloomy report about potential funding for VLR, construction has started on an 800-metre track for Coventry, Very Light Railway project. Colas Rail has been commissioned for the new section near Coventry train station and Coventry University. Approved by Coventry Council in January, the second phase of the project is now commenced. It consists of a twin track connecting Coventry train station at Station Square and Coventry University Technology Park at Puma Way. Colas Rail is adopting a streamlined approach that accelerates delivery and minimises disruption, they said. Surveys have been completed and procurement of the track slabs is in progress. Speaking about the project, Ian Anderson, Managing Director for Urban and Industries, said, "We are thrilled to be starting work on the second phase of the Coventry VLR, and this next phase represents a major step forward in bringing an innovative, sustainable light rail transport solution to Coventry. Colas Rail is proud to be part of a project that is not only transforming the infrastructure in the city, but also setting new standards for innovation in light rail systems across the UK." Councillor Jim O'Boyle said, "We worked with Colas Rail to deliver our first demonstration route, so I'm glad to welcome them back to the team for the next phase, which sees our innovative track and vehicle operating in live traffic."
A bin man has listed 3 items you should never put in your recycling bin, otherwise the trash will be left outside your house. It's important that when you're putting things into your bins, you try your best not to contaminate them and leave the rubbish in the correct place. According to bin man Ashley, bin men can decline to collect your rubbish if particular items are in the incorrect bins, and these include the following items. pizza boxes. Pizza boxes should not be put in the recycling bin. They should be in your general waste bin, whatever colour that might be. Let's just make this clear. Pizza boxes, general waste bin, not recycling bin. That's all I needed to say. It doesn't matter what colour your general waste bin is, pizza boxes go in it. While some pizza boxes can be recycled, this should only be done if they're clean and dry. To do this correctly, you must remove and dispose of any greasy food remnants or stain sections, particularly the base. You may not be aware that refuse collectors can reject a complete recycling bin if it contains non-recyclable, contaminated items. A second no-no, crisp packets. They do not go in your recycling bin. You take them to the supermarket and recycle them there. Just like carrier bags, just like film and bubble wrap, all that stuff does not go in your recycling bin. Take it to the tip. They can sometimes dispose of it there differently, or take it to the supermarket. There's loads of stuff. Polystyrene is plastic, but it doesn't go in your recycling bin because it takes up too much room. And it costs too much money to recycle, because there's hardly any plastic in it. Please check before you put things in your bin. Normally, it's tins and bottles, and easy things to put in the recycling. And the third one is wrapping paper. It can be confusing to know which elements you can recycle, but it depends on the wrapping paper. So if you have wrapping paper, what you should be able to do with it is screw it into a ball. If it stays in a ball, it's just paper and can go in your paper recycling bin. If it's got lots of sellotape or labels all over it, take them off and then just put it in the paper bin. But if you screw it into a ball and it starts expanding back out again, that's got mainly plastic in it and should not go in your paper bin. It only takes 2 seconds to scrunch the wrapping to see if it's suitable for recycling, so be sure to do it before throwing it away.
Planners have given the green light to a scheme to regenerate part of Wykyn following the demolition of 2 tower blocks. The scheme will see 63 homes built on land off Attoxahall Road, occupied by the now demolished Vincent Wiles House and William Malcolm House, which is soon to be bulldozed. All of the citizen properties will be for social rent and will consist of 39 houses and 24 apartments. There had been 144 flats in the demolished towers in the demolished tower and 112 in the other. A design statement drawn up by architects Bailey Garner explains both buildings were part of a broader effort during the mid-20th century to address housing shortages and provide modern living spaces. Over time, however, they faced issues of deterioration and were eventually included in this regeneration project to replace them with 63 modern homes. Their report adds that a number of good quality perimeter trees will be retained where possible and incorporated into the proposals. It goes on, the new development will replace outdated high-rise flats with a mixture of 2, 3 and 4 bedroom homes, offering better living conditions and more sustainable housing options. The regeneration project involves consultation with the local community to ensure the new development meets residents' needs and preferences. The enclosed site can foster its own identity and community, benefiting from tree-lined boundaries and existing greenery for privacy and visual appeal. By incorporating new amenities and green spaces, the project will enhance the overall quality of life and create family housing as well as usable public open space. That public consultation highlighted concerns over untidiness and dumping issues. The report explains that citizens hope evergreen hedgerows will enclose boundaries to enhance security. Also, the layout has been designed to maximise visibility, ensuring that public and communal areas are overlooked by windows and active spaces to help reduce antisocial behaviour and crime. Planners at Coventry City Council approved the scheme, adding, "The proposed development is considered to be acceptable in principle and will not result in any significant impact upon visual amenity, neighbour amenity, highway safety, ecology or infrastructure, subject to relevant conditions and contributions." The Housing Strategy Team welcomes and supports this proposal. They note that there is a shortage of social rented houses in the city, with the Home Finder register now standing at around 10,500 applicants. Social rented housing, particularly larger family-sized homes, is their highest current priority. They particularly welcome the inclusion of 12 four-bedded houses.
Opposition councillors have slammed the ruling Labour Group's plan to stage a two-day city centre summer event in place of the Godiva Festival this year, calling it a hodgepodge and a jolly. A figure of £400,000 has been allocated to a Godiva in the City event to take place in July, an amount agreed as part of the budget approved at last week's full council meeting. The City Council announced earlier this month that the popular festival, which has been running for more than 25 years at the War Memorial Park, was being paused due to rising costs and industry challenges. A statement explained that a full review would be carried out to see how it could be delivered sustainably in the future, and that it would be replaced by a new summer programme, including Godiva in the City, on Saturday the 4th and Sunday, July the 5th. Speaking at the council meeting, Councillor Peter Mayles said, "Last year the Conservative group called for a review into the future of the Godiva Festival, and we are pleased that the Labour group has responded to our calls. It is not appropriate to allocate funding for an event until this review has been completed. This is a bizarre proposal and further confirms that they have more money than they know what to do with." Tory group leader Councillor Gary Ridley, in response to Labour's budget proposals, added, "Is there anything that sums up the wasteful spending in this budget better than a £400,000 allocation to the Godiva Festival that is not even happening? Coventry has been known as the ghost town, and now it has its own ghost festival to go with it. We should be very clear about what we do with the Godiva Festival. Pull it for this year. Save the money and look at what we do next year." There was also criticism from Reform, with Councillor Jackie Gardner saying, "Going ahead with a hodgepodge would damage the brand. There are more pressing priorities for the city than a summer jolly for some."
A Coventry neighbourhood police team has said it will use mounted police officers to tackle specific crimes on its patch. Concerns among residents regarding car crime and house break-ins has seen Stoke and Wykeham neighbourhood police teams pinpoint these issues as key priorities. This week, they announced that residents can expect to see horses trotting down the area's residential streets. Officers highlighted the issue last month, stating there had been a recent increase in vehicle-related offences, including a number of smash-and-grab offences, while burglaries were also recognised as a community concern. Regarding the car crime, a force spokesman said this week, "This remains a priority. The areas are subject to targeted patrols during peak times, particularly late evenings, to deter offending and identify suspects. The mounted unit has also been deployed on several occasions to provide additional high-visibility reassurance patrols." "The tactic is obviously working," the spokesman explained. "There have been several arrests made recently in connection with these offences, and those individuals charged to court. Crime prevention advice continues to be shared, and we strongly encourage members of the public not to leave items on display in vehicles. We thank the community for their continued support and ask that any suspicious behaviour is reported to the police promptly.
A good night's sleep is essential for boosting both physical and mental well-being. Yet countless people find themselves either struggling to nod off or waking in the early hours and unable to drift back to sleep. Dr. Jack Mosley, son of the late Dr. Michael Mosley, has shared his top tips for getting back to sleep after waking in the night. As a weight management specialist, Jack believes sleep is crucial for those looking to shed pounds or simply improve their overall health. He points out that many people who struggle to sleep often find themselves reaching for unhealthy snacks. Jack said, "I would say that sleep is absolutely vital. It is so important to look at your overall lifestyle and make some of these changes, because we know there are studies where people who are sleep deprived ate up to 400 calories more per day. Sleep can affect your mental health too. When we're tired and stressed, we're not reaching for the broccoli, we're reaching for the carbohydrate snacks and getting that quick energy boost." Jack urges people to establish a solid bedtime routine. This approach is supported by the NHS, which states that a good sleep routine, including retiring at a consistent time and finding a means of unwinding, is important for a good night's rest. For those who find themselves struggling to drift back off after waking during the night, Jack has two straightforward tips to help you nod off. He says, if you are someone who is waking up in the night rather than just sitting there stressing about not getting back to sleep, one thing you can do is the 4-2-4 approach, where you breathe in for 4 seconds, hold your breath for 2, and breathe out for 4. The other thing, if that's not working, is actually taking yourself out of the bedroom for a bit. Go to the sofa. He says read a boring book, but maybe read a book. And then, when you feel tired, go back to bed, instead of sitting there for hours worrying that you're not sleeping. Jack heads up the Fast 800 online program, which he describes as a lifestyle program. It's there to help people with other aspects that we know are so important in your health, like exercise, including aerobic, and also mindfulness.
A plea has been made for a fly-tipping hit piece of land in Coventry to be transformed into a children's playground. Locals say that the land at Budbrook Close stands unused. They claim that this leaves it at risk of becoming a dumping ground for fly-tippers. This is an issue that has blighted the area in the past. So, to make the most of the land, campaigners are calling on the City Council to take action and turn it into a playground. They've launched a petition which reads, "For several years, this site was affected by fly-tipping, creating an unsafe and unsightly environment. Following a major clean-up effort, the land is now clear but remains unused and at risk of future neglect. We believe this presents an ideal opportunity for positive redevelopment. A children's playground at Budbrook Close will provide a safe space for local children, encourage outdoor activity and bring families together. Developing the site will also help prevent further fly-tipping and antisocial behaviour by giving the area a clear and valued purpose." The petition asks the Council to consider the proposal and engage with the local community regarding possible next steps.
A Coventry student has hailed her journey on BBC The Traitors as phenomenal. Jade Scott made it to the final 5 but narrowly missed out to Rachel Duffy and Stephen Libby. Jade said the show changed her profoundly as she revealed the family tragedy and personal challenges she faced. She endured tough moments with the other contestants, but said it was a challenge worth having. She reflected on her time on the Traitors, saying, "It is like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I wanted to be a faithful, because you get to try and figure out who the traitors are. It is like a giant game that you get to play with people in real life." But Jade had to overcome her shyness in the early days of filming. She said, "I was quite reserved compared to a lot of the other cast members, and it took me a while to come out of my shell. And you are not quite used to having 21 sets of eyes on you. It is just something you grow into." Asked if she would return to the Traitors, she said, "I think I would. The challenges were just so much fun, and there was so much thought put into them. You get a sense for how people play the game, and the different strategies that people came up with were incredible. So yes, I think I would, 100%. Jade also reflected on watching the show unfold on TV, saying, "It was really odd watching the first few episodes because obviously I did a lot of growing in confidence throughout the show. And as I watched the first episodes, I was thinking, who is she? Why am I doing that?" Reflecting on the friendship she formed, she said, "We all got on so well, and they are the most amazing group of people I have ever met, and that I would never have run into. We have so much fun when we go out, and we are all now good friends, despite all the heat." Jade is now focusing on her PhD at Warwick University.
Outlook News.
And a big thank you to our newsreaders today. That's Nigel and Elaine. A couple of announcements. Sunrise is at 6:48 and sunset is at 17:48. That's 12 minutes to 6 in Albany. Now, another announcement. The shop. There's always bargains, but at the moment you can get ladies' shoes for £2 a pair. And the winter and summer ones are a huge collection. So go along and if you need some shoes, get there quick. They're going like hotcakes. Now, I'm delighted to say that we've been joined for the update from the Hub by Joe. Joe, do you need any shoes?
Hello. No, actually, not right now. I've got a cupboard full. That's probably, okay. I'm not alone in that either. But yes, I think I'm good. It's good to know they're there, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Winter coats are here too. They're having a sale.
Oh, right.
So,
yes.
Before the spring arrives, right. If you want to prepare for the winter next year.
Yes, yep. Okay. Coats as well.
Well, welcome everybody. Hello. It's nice to be with you again. I'm standing in today for both Hugh and Chris. Mm-hmm. So they send their best and they've given me some notes as to things they wanted me to tell you about.
Right.
So, first and foremost, a couple of news items from Chris. He might have mentioned this before, but there is a interesting talk type theatre event going on the 26th of March, which is a Thursday, at the Central Library in Coventry. It's called POC, I believe. It's a sort of eerie, immersive story being acted out and narrated. And it sounds like it's kind of quite descriptive mm-hmm. and quite evocative. So he is just mentioning that to anyone who might be interested. It's on Thursday, the 26th of March, and it's in the evening at 7:15 to 9:15. Mm-hmm. If you and your family members are interested in going to that, you can get the tickets from a ticket site, but I don't have the address here for it, I'm afraid. So ask us at reception or ask Chris, or perhaps look on the Central Library website. So I've got a little bit of script here that says that the librarian in this story writes by moonlight and locks away his stories at dawn.
Oh.
But every now and then, by candlelight, under the watchful glow of a single brass lamp, he reads one or two of his chilling tales to rapt audiences across the country. Mm-hmm. Sounds good, doesn't it?
It does.
So that's the first thing. The second thing Chris wanted me to mention to you, this is quite interesting. We've had a bit of a new development with connections with the Coventry Charterhouse off the London Road, right next to the old Bluecoat School where I went to school. Used to be a total wreck, that building. It's now been beautifully restored and is now owned, I think, by the National Trust. And they have some interesting things happening there anyway, tours, but there's a lady there who is preparing to run some sound-based walks around the garden. Her name's Helen. Chris and Claire went and met her a couple of weeks ago and tried out the planned
yes,
walk.
Yes, he said about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So the idea is that you would go along, be given a headset, and there'd be a route around the garden, and at each point there are different noises and different sounds that are captured, some of which are... She's personally recorded in the garden, so creaking of a tree, for example, and local bird song, and some of which she's obviously looked at what's in the garden but got the sounds off the internet. So she's got some fascinating things going on, like the sound of a slug eating a mushroom, for example, or the sound of a snail crawling about. So it's obviously very imaginative, and Chris and Claire really enjoyed it. They thought it was excellent. So what they're proposing to do is... they're talking to the walking group initially. One of our walking groups meets on a Wednesday. So if you already go to the walking group, you may hear about it through Peter. On Wednesday, the 15th of April at 10:15, they're planning on organising a group, perhaps just from the walking group, or maybe there'll be spaces for some extras. I think there is a maximum number because they've only got 15 headsets. So Chris will organise all that. But if you are part of the walking group for Wednesday, or you're really interested, please let reception know and they'll let Chris know. I expect if it goes well, we'll organise another one in future. So I think that's rather a nice thing.
There's a nice cafe there as well.
Yeah, quite imaginative, isn't it? It's a lovely garden there as well. I've watched it develop and I think they've done a great job. Okay, and on to news from Hugh. On the practical front, first of all, he might have mentioned this previously, but the details have now been firmed up. So... this is for men out there, visually impaired men over the age of 40 or non-visually impaired over the age of 40. We have been talking with, working with Coventry and North Warwickshire Prostate Cancer Support Group. They have a well-developed programme of running prostate cancer blood checks, PSA testing, and they do that at various locations all across the country, I believe. And we're going to host one here on Saturday, the 6th of June. Our main intention behind this, of course, is to capture people who are in the visually impaired community in Coventry, because it's much harder for them, as we know, to get this sort of information and to access healthcare generally, as well as preventative healthcare. So if you or someone you know is a man over 40 who's visually impaired and you would like to take the offer up, we are going to be booking people in. And if the visually impaired people that want to do it, we will be helping them here if they need it to register online, go through the health questionnaire they need to complete, making sure they can do it, and if necessary, organising minibus transport on the day. For those that are not visually impaired, men are still welcome to take up a place. They can book online and it will cost them £25. We are putting in a bid for a funder to see if we can fund the programme for the visually impaired group. So it won't cost, we hope. I'll have to confirm that once we've got the money, but we are hoping to be able to offer it free for visually impaired people. All of the blood tests are done by professionals from the NHS, and all of the follow-up will be done through the NHS. So anyone who needs results acting on in some way, that will all be properly professionally dealt with and referred to your GP. So really worth mentioning that to anyone in your life that you think might be in that category. And if they just happen to live locally or want to take up the chance, then go online, look at the Coventry and North Warwickshire Prostate Cancer Support Group and look for the date that's happening here on the 6th of June. You can register that way and come along and pay on the day. Second thing from Hugh is we're quite pleased about this one. Hugh's been working hard, I think, with Chris to develop what we're calling the Coventry Vision Hub Shine Awards. This is something we want to find a way of acknowledging those organisations and companies locally who we know are doing really good service for visually impaired people. There are some that we hear about regularly. Coventry Building Society, for example, in Coventry, has done a lot with some of our service users. And, you know, they go that extra mile to help people. So where we recognise, where we hear about things like that and we get enough feedback from our service users, we would like then to be able to do something to go to that company, that yeah. organisation, and say, look, you're doing a great job. The feedback we're getting from our people is this. And that's what's really helpful for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that hopefully will just build relationships with them yeah. as well. So it's the Coventry Vision Hub Shine Awards. Hugh is busy working on promoting it and putting together some sort of citation letter they can put on their notice boards in a shop or wherever, and something for their windows as well. Mm. So it'll be a real visual award, if you yeah. like. So it'll be an ongoing project. But if any of you have had really good service as a visually impaired blind person and you'd like that person, organisation acknowledged, then come and tell us about it, because we would like to gather that kind of story, that mm-hmm. kind of experience, and make sure it gets recognised.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some good people out there helping. Mm. And then those that aren't doing so well, we can go to them and say, hey,
yes.
what about this? Mm-hmm. So, Coventry Vision Hub Shine Awards. And the last thing I have to talk to you about is the new group that we want to set up called Mindfulness. You may or may not have heard of mindfulness. It's very big in counselling circles and mental health circles. It's evolved out of counselling and Buddhist backgrounds, actually, mindfulness. It's very much a sort of westernised way of meditating or using meditation techniques. And it's extremely helpful for stress reduction, anxiety reduction, and just creating a space in which you can really relax more than we can usually manage on our own during the day. So they're very gentle guided meditation sessions. And we have a practitioner who's qualified. She'd like to run these for us. So Hugh is very keen that you come and ask us more if you're interested, or sign up in reception.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be running here as one of our activity sessions. We haven't yet got a date in mind, and we haven't formulated exactly how often it will run, but we just like to gauge interest.
Yeah.
A couple of last little things. There is a theatre trip running on the 25th of March to see The Unfriend. That's at the Criterion Theatre. As you know, we go once a month. This one is but really heavily subscribed, so the list is full at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we probably won't manage to put any more people on that list unless somebody drops out. But if you're really keen to get on the waiting list, just let reception know. We need to get people to pay in advance for the tickets, because we have to pay the theatre. And as you know, we do a sort of touch tour before the performance, and then we come back here, have fish and chips, and then we go off and look at the theatre. And finally, Hugh had a visit this week from Synaptic. Most of you will know Synaptic is a company that produces visually impaired friendly phones and tablets, well-priced usually, and they have really good customer service. And they're now offering a smartwatch, which is actually a pretty good price at £299. Excuse me. It's, as Hugh puts it here, it's more than a smartwatch. It's an actual phone that you wear on your wrist, and it talks to you, and you can talk to it.
Gosh.
So it's pretty good if you want a voice-activated phone and you want it to be on your, you know, person in that way. If you're interested, let us know. And then what we'll probably do is get them in to demonstrate it to a group of people.
Yeah.
So technology moves on apace, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
So thank you all very much. Nice to speak to you.
And you. Thanks very much, Jo.
Thank you.
And now here's Sarah with the sport.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Actually, it's quite a positive sport this week. But I'm not going to give everything away yet. Oh, no. You know me. Right. Let's start with football as usual. And I'm afraid there's quite a lot of it. On Wednesday the 25th of February, Coventry travelled away to Bramall Lane, the home of Sheffield United. Now, Sheffield United were one of the teams relegated last year from the Premiership. In fact, they'd only gone up the previous season. Bit of a yo-yo club, you could say. But also they have Callum O'Hare and Gus Hamer playing for them, two of our former stars. So it was quite difficult listening, actually, and having to remember, no, they're playing for the opposition. At that point, we were 2 points, bad English there, but never mind, between friends. At that stage, we were 2 points on top of that league, as Middlesbrough could only draw on the previous day. Aha. So, well, the first half was actually quite difficult listening for a City fan, and they seemed on top of it, to be truthful. But somehow, we came away at half-time with a 0-0 draw, and we weren't going to argue about that. Oh, no. But then, in the third minute of the second half, wouldn't you know it, they scored. Actually, it was quite a relatively easy goal. I don't think we'd woken up then. But how things changed. And within about 3 minutes, Hadji Wright made it 1-1 by scoring for us. But don't rest on your laurels, oh no, because 5 minutes later, we scored again, or should I say Jack Ridoni scored again for City. City 2-1. Now, Jack Ridoni's goal was described by CWR as potentially the goal of the season. And I listen to the matches when they're on the national channel Talk Sport, because I like a bit of an independent view, and they can't stop eulogising about Coventry, and Jack Ridoni in particular. And apparently we've got an absolutely phenomenal back four. Just don't say it too loud, Talk Sport, or those Premier League talent scouts will be looking. Oh yes, we hopefully will have a Premier League talent scout next year. Still, back to reality and the time of the present. So, close of play on Wednesday night, we were top of the league by 5 points. That's looking more healthy, Sarah. On Saturday, well, Mark Robbins, our former manager, much loved, bought his new side, Stoke. Well, I say new, he's been in charge for about 12 months, to the Coventry Building Society Arena. It was also Legends Day, where some of our former players, I believe this year there were 51, get a sort of walk onto the pitch, and they get a do, and loads of press interviews. And I mean, there were quite a few of the team of 87 that won the FA Cup are the backbone of that group. But it was great this year to see Max Biamu, who, as you may remember, missed the penalty at Wembley, but we love him. Now back to the match. Well, it was set to be a banana skin. Going into it, as I just said, we were 5 points on top of that league. And on the 18th minute, Mr. Wright, Hadji of nature, made it 1-0 to City. We apparently, in that first half, had 13 shots on goal. But they had a tremendous goalkeeper who's on loan from Premier side Brentford. But wouldn't you know it, on the very last kick of the first half, they made it 1-1. Huh. So the second half, well, I didn't know whether to listen to it, turn it off, walk around, whatever, whatever. But I listened to it. And it dragged out. And then at the end of the 90 minutes, it was 1-1. Oh, football's so unfair sometimes. However, there were 6 minutes extra time. At that point, I did turn the radio off, I confess. But I couldn't keep it off for long, and 3 minutes later, I switched it back on to hear of goal celebration. Yes, Jack Redoni had scored again for Coventry. Apparently, according to newsreader Pete, it was a lovely kick straight to the goal off a long play-in by Ellis Sims. And it took a slight deflection which slowed its route down. But it went in, cue absolute and total pandemonium by the City fans in the stadium. And I suspect a quick exit by most Stoke fans. Anyway, at the end of that match, and with Middlesbrough playing tonight, I'm recording on Monday, we were 8 points on top of that league. I heard an interview this morning with one of the country's leading bookmakers, or the local manager of the shop of one of the country's leading bookmakers, and he said, well, actually, Coventry are now odds on to go up, and it's not such a matter of if as when. Oh, that is so wonderful, but please, may it continue. We have another 11 matches to get through. Now, the next match is scheduled to be Saturday the 7th against Bristol away at Ashton Gate with a 3 p.m. kickoff. However, Bristol at the moment are still in the FA Cup, subject to them winning their rematch against Port Vale tomorrow night, that's Tuesday. So it may be on or it may be not. But here's hoping it will be, because we don't want a fortnight off at the moment. We're doing so well. But I'm afraid it wasn't such good news for most of our non-league sides. I'm afraid both Stratford and Leamington lost 2-0. Leamington, I know, were away to Worksop. That followed a further defeat for Leamington midweek, which now sees them really not so much firmly rooted at the bottom of their league, but firmly cemented. Stratford midweek did at least squeak a draw. And I'm afraid it was the end of their Wembley dream for my little Coventry United, who lost their quarter-final at the FA Vase 3-0 away. Now here's my slinky link. Coventry United play their home matches at Butts Park Arena, as do Coventry Rugby Club. But this weekend, Coventry Rugby Club were away to Amtill. Well, they trailed at half-time 12 points to 10. But thanks to a late surge, they came away with a 40 points to 36 victory, taking not only the points for winning, but the bonus point for scoring 4 tries. In fact, they've now scored 101 tries this season, apparently. They are now fourth in their league, which is called the Champ. One final point on the rugby. Wasn't it great this weekend to actually see that Wales didn't lose? Well, you could have thought it was in honour of St David's Day, but I think it was more likely the sad fact that the Six Nations was having a week off, so none of them won, lost or drew. Oh well, there's only one way up, Wales. Win, please! Now, on to cricket. Now, I was a little bit premature last week and I got it totally wrong, because having beaten Sri Lanka, I said that I thought that England were now in the semi-final of the T20 World Cup. Far from it. They had to play all three sides in their half of the Super 8. Confused? Yeah, well, they will keep changing the rules. Anyway, they did just that. Pakistan, beaten, tick. New Zealand, beaten, tick. In fact, England became the first side to qualify for the semis. So when you think of where we'd come from, when we really were no opers, only squeaking that draw against Scotland and just getting past our first opponents. Anyway, unfortunately, the bad news is that the semi-final is against India, the hosts. Anyway, it will be played on Thursday with the final, should we get there. Well, the final will be, anyway, whoever's there, on Sunday. That is Sunday the 8th. Also on Sunday, it's the beginning of the F1 Grand Prix season. But I assure you, I won't be watching it live. The first Grand Prix is at 4 a.m. in Australia. Well, there must be a potted highlights programme on it somewhere. Anyway, lovely listeners, that has been your sport. And I hope to be bringing you more positive news next week. Have a lovely week. Bye.
Formula One back already? Well, I'm not getting up at 4 a.m. to watch it either. I've got far better things to do at that time of day. Sleeping's one of them. And now here's Dave with your postbag for the week.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, and welcome to your postbag this week. I was so sorry to hear that Edwina was in hospital with pneumonia, so I went to visit her. I found her tired, but her usual cheerful, chatty self. While I was there, she asked me if she could record a piece for you from a hospital bed. It's about spring fashions. Here she is.
Hi everybody, it's Edwina. I do hope you've been keeping well and happy. I have missed doing my different pieces, but I'm just going to have a go at fashion, because so many of you love hearing me fashion each spring. So this spring, the colours are to be bright. So you wear a turquoise, a khaki, red, all the bright colours. Your material is cotton. Giant sunglasses. And on your feet, casuals and sandals. That's it then. Take care, everybody. I love doing this and think of you and care. Bye.
That was really wonderful of Edwina to record a message for you in her low state of health. She does set a great example for you to send in messages. It was at her own request. Send Edwina your get well wishes via postbag. Now, Bob Syme talks about the fact that Outlook is 50 years old on September the 16th this year. Here's Bob.
This is Bob Syme. I was really surprised 50 years that we've been going. I joined community broadcasting about fortnight from the start. I've been there all the time. I don't know how many people are still listening that was listening all that time ago. But I joined with Martin Green and Ashley Thomas and Malcolm Liggins. Malcolm used to pick me up. He'd done the sport all them years ago. And I used to run different shows and concerts all over working men's clubs to raise the money for community broadcasting. It's been a real different celebrities in the time I was with it. I know Margaret has been there a long time, and you have Dave yourself, many years have been. I remember you joining, I remember Margaret joining. And when Margaret joined, I used to run the charity shops, and my mother and my auntie used to go and help. And when Margaret was there, my mother always said, Margaret Bunnell is the nicest person that my mother had ever met. So that's a nice compliment from Margaret. She, I know she's on the tape at the CBS at the time, but I thought of it when you said 50 years, because my mother passed away a good few years ago. That's what she always says. That Margaret that helps us in the shop, the nicest lady I've ever met, she says. But that's how I used to raise the funds. I was fundraiser, then I took over as chairman all them years ago. But it's amazing how time goes. With like Nigel has been there. He was a friend of Malcolm's as well. Obviously, we lost Malcolm. We've lost a lot of the original people who set up community broadcasting. But hey-ho, we're still going after 50 years. I don't know if I'm the only one still that was there, like Roy Brewer and Tina, there, but it's just surprising how time goes. I hope everyone enjoys it. Let's have a lot more people putting in on postback. Keep Dave busy. It's for you, not for us. It's for you, people, for the listeners. So use postback. That's all from me, Bob Syme. Let's hear from you now.
Thank you, Bob. So what are we going to do to celebrate the 50th birthday of Outlook? Now, not so long ago, Elizabeth did a report on wassailing of the apple trees at Aulsley Wall Garden. Well, she's done another at the Charter House on the London Road, which has recently been run by the National Trust, and as a result has had many thousands of visitors. Here's Elizabeth.
Hi, everyone. This week we were wassailing the apple trees again. This was in the beautiful grounds of the Charter House, which is now run by the National Trust. The Sherborne Ladies' Choir wore garlands of ivy around their heads. A guy accompanied them on guitar, and two others were on tambourines. Very melodic. After anointing the trees to ensure a good harvest, we drank warm cider with cinnamon and cranberries. Finally, we were regaled by Morris dancers, ensuring these centuries-old traditions.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth, for that lovely report. The wassailing is really a fun event. And since the National Trust has taken over the running of the Charter House, it's open far more often, and it's really worth going along to. Check with the Charter House website. Robert Franklin tells us that he once paddled across the channel. There were 3 disabled and 3 able-bodied in the boat. They were doing it in memory of a murdered schoolgirl aged 13 called Millie Dowler, raising money for a children's charity. Robert has taken part in rugby sports days. They're called Have a Go Days, where he has taken part in swimming galas, bagatelle, bowling, etc., and has won medals. And now here's Doreen to tell you what she thinks of Outlook and the importance of postbag.
Hello, everybody. It's Doreen here, speaking to you all again. Sorry you haven't heard from me for a long time. Our Doreen's struggling along with a shoulder, a frozen shoulder, but never mind. We carry on with it, although we nurse it and look after ourselves, because that's the main thing. I have been listening to the outcome, which was being said. Nice to see Elizabeth, also Janet, at the Torch meeting on the 31st of January. What a beautiful meeting we had. It brought back a lot of memories to me when Nigel was talking about John Bunyan. John Bunyan, we went to see, I believe it was Bedworth or something like that, in the church which I go to in Parkgate Road. And that was in 2006. We went there. We went to the Madame True store there. And what we saw was John Bunyan. From his story, he was put into jail. Because I couldn't see it very well, they let me feel his hands, and his hands felt cold, and he had the Bible in his hands. But it was very, very interesting of John Bunyan's story. And like I said, that day, on 2006, it was a beautiful sunny day. And at the same time, they had a river there, and they've got the swans, and you could see them. It was very, very peaceful. And as we went around from John Bunyan's Madame Stew store, we went in some of the churches in Bedworth, and it was very, very nice. I'm a person that likes exploring. So there we go. And all our listeners, I hope that something as well, that you are taking in what Dave is saying, because Dave is right, postbag is really important. I've loved postbag all the time it started from the 50 years we've had it. Okay, all, so take care. That's my little message. Hope to speak to you again shortly. Bye, Doreen.
Thank you, Doreen, and for stressing the importance of postbag. Graham, advising you, if you're a man, to have a PSA test for prostate cancer. He gives you some more information for a self-test bowel cancer screening if you are visually impaired that you do at home. Here's Graham.
Speaking of PSA tests, you could also get a bowel cancer test every 2 years if you fall into the category of people who are entitled for it. I'm not sure what the category is now. I think you've got to be over a certain age. You may even get a letter from them inviting you to take part. In fact, you'll get a kit sent you automatically. But what they don't tell you is that they can amend the test to suit people with visual impairment. They don't tell you that. So you need to contact them on 0800 707 6060. That's 0800 707 6060. But as I say, make sure they know that you do have a visual impairment, and if they do contact you automatically with a kit, because they send the kit out with a letter, it's not going to be suitable. So they can amend the test to suit you, though in my experience, you may still need a bit of help.
Thank you, Graham, for that very helpful information. Thank you for your messages this week. Please keep them coming in. Okay, thank you, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And thanks to Dave for this week's postbag. Let's make sure we keep postbag going. Yet another Warwickshire village now. And this week, Elaine is going to tell us about the village of Radway.
Radway. Visitors today see the wooded slopes of Edge Hill, scene of a civil war battle in 1642. A blend of past and present, and from the top, a panorama of 12 counties. Also from the top, the round tower built in 1750 watches over Radway from the spot where the king's standard was set up before the battle. The tower's architect, Sanderson Miller, planted trees below the tower and was also responsible for the meaningless turrets added to the once beautiful grange. The Stoneleigh monks were the early owners of the grange. They demolished the existing building and built the main part of the present house. A well was sunk and fish ponds were made and well stocked. John Washington was the owner during the Battle of Edge Hill, kinsman to George Washington, the first president of the USA. Today, the Grange still plays a part in the community life. The parish church, dedicated to St. Peter, and the Methodist chapel, both celebrated a centenary in 1966. When the old church was demolished, foundations of a previous one were discovered, and the Norman period gargoyles were dug up and incorporated into the tower of the present church. The five bells in the tower are enthusiastically rung on every possible occasion. Long ago, there was a strong association with the Quakers, and the old meeting house is now a private dwelling, and a garden covers the burial ground. Horses have always been important in bygone days for work and transport, providing useful local employment. Blacksmith, wheelwright, carrier, saddler, all had a prominent part to play. Now there are more horses than ever before, but used for different purposes. The demand today is for sport and recreation. An early attempt at education was a dame school under the patronage of squire and vicar in a cottage at the Grange entrance. In 1851, Charles Chambers of Ivy Lodge built the school, and in 1852, an excellent reading room, now called the Institute. He left both properties in the care of his cousin Georgiana. Eventually, some board school regulations were incorporated, and in 1912, the County Council took over. In 1966, progress dictated that the school be closed, and now the children travel to Tysoe and Kyneton, and the school is now a house.
I've played cricket at Radway, and what a picturesque ground it was. We all know about the famous James Herriot books, as well as the TV series, but now Gerard Gilbert meets the person who trains all the animals appearing in All Creatures Great and Small. It's read by Sue.
The winter evenings are long and dark. The news is often dire, and politics ever more divisive. Where does one escape to for a cosy hug? For more than 6 million viewers in Britain and tens of millions more across the globe, the answer is 30s and 40s Yorkshire, as portrayed in Five's hit period drama All Creatures Great and Small. Over 6 series, these gentle and beautifully crafted takes on James Herriot's veterinary tales have captivated viewers in more than 100 countries. Warm-hearted and cosy, without being fluffy, with real emotions and a keen sense of changing times, the show centres on Skeldale House in the fictional Yorkshire Dales town of Derby, filmed in and around the real-life market town of Grassington. The principal two-legged characters are James Herriot himself, played by Nicholas Ralph, his wife Helen, Rachel Shenton, his irascible boss Siegfried Farnan, Samuel West, Siegfried's younger brother Tristan, Callum Woodhouse, and their uber-capable housekeeper Audrey Hall, Anna Madeley. Uncredited, however, are the scores of creatures great and small of the programme title. This support cast of horses, cows, goats, chickens, geese, cats, rabbits, cats and dogs has to come from somewhere. And that place is a holding farm 15 miles from Grassington, owned by animal trainer Jill Clark. Jill lives with 11 dogs and 22 cats, all of them actors, except for 2 farm moggies. Among this domestic menagerie are some of the four-legged stars of the series, including Tricky Woo, the absurdly high-maintenance Pekingese owned by Patricia Hodges' character, Mrs. Pumphrey, and Skeldale House's resident golden retriever, Jess. Tricky Woo's real name, by the way, is Dora, while Jess is actually called Ernie. Until last year, Tricky was played by Derek. But I retired Derek because he had trouble with his eyes, says Jill. We searched for a lookalike, and we were very lucky to get Dora. She doesn't need so much makeup, because she has a slightly greyer face, which suits the show, because Tricky Woo is getting on a bit now. The dogs go into makeup? Yes, we still need to do a bit of makeup and underneath the eyes, just to bring them on a bit more. To make them shine, they do a bit of powder. If the idea of animals seated in the makeup chair seems absurd, it's all in a day's work for Jill, who was introduced to the film world in the 80s when she ran a dog training school with her then husband. Somebody just turned up and asked, "Can you train a dog to bite a postman?" Because the post office was doing an advertising campaign, she says. It just went on from there. My first film was The Bounty with Mel Gibson in 1984. We had little cabin dogs that actually belonged to the prop master and street dogs, rats. And the following year, she supplied the animals for the Tom Cruise movie, Legend, and, joined by her son Dean in 2014, her business has boomed. Other memorable gigs include providing the 70 sheep, 12 horses, 3 cows, 2 goats, 10 chickens and 3 sheepdogs used in the opening ceremony of the 2012 London Olympics. And while Jill and Dean have plenty of work elsewhere, it's all creatures great and small that has steadily busied them since 2020. One of the most obvious problems facing Jill is the particular pet hates, as it were, of the cast. Fortunately, West kept rats as a child and has no problem handling Siegfried's pet rodent. But Woodhouse, just like his character Tristan, has a fear of snakes. Callum said, "I'll never hold it. I'll never hold it." But he did, says Jill, of the scene in Series 5 where Tristan had to deal with an escaped python. "Just give him time. Don't push it. Let him do it calmly in his own time." It's a philosophy she extends to all of the animals, including Clive, an enormous, fearsome-looking bull that Shenton had to handle in the first series. Clive was the gentlest giant, but really scary for someone who's never met a bull before, says Jill. "We told Rachel, don't be scared, just grab his head collar and walk off with him. But if you see us running, keep up." Cows are problematic in other ways, including the logistical nightmare of moving them around amid stringent bovine TB regulations. They're also herd animals, with a tendency to stampede when spooked. If you stand in a field and a horse charges at you, if you wave your arms, they'll go round you. A cow just goes straight over the top. Cows can and do kill people. And then, of course, there are those scenes when the cows give birth. Another logistical problem with pregnant animals brought to the holding farm just before their third trimester. They dress the set and put the cameras up. "And we stay on watch 24 hours a day," says Dean. "We have a little WhatsApp group and everyone turns up when we message. It's like a closed set, only the cameraman and us and Andy Barrett, the vet. They film it like a documentary and then separately the actors will film their scenes. They then just cut in pieces from the documentary birth and splice it in together." It might go without saying, but the actors never actually carry out any of the treatments on the live animals. They'll go as far as they can with the live ones, and then, when the surgical procedures begin, the camera angles are changed so that the viewers don't see the whole animal and prosthetic models are employed. Otherwise, Jill and Dean can train a cow to limp with lots of food and lots of praise, and even get cats to lie down and appear to be asleep on the operating table. We don't anaesthetise them. They're just trained to lie flat. Depending on the cat's temperament, you can do quite a bit with them. Inevitably, a bond is formed between the regular human and animal cast. Everyone's all over them all the time, says Jill. The dogs even go in the green room with them. Callum and Ernie are always together. Ernie runs straight up to him every time. Tricky Woo and Jess had starring roles in this year's Christmas special, and I fondly imagine that Dora and Ernie were curled up on a sofa watching the programme with Jill. I'll definitely be watching the Christmas special, she says, although I have read the scripts, it's totally different seeing it on the screen.
They say you should never work with children or animals. Now, written in stone, this is taken from the National Trust magazine, and geologist Anjala Carter reveals how rocks can be a meeting point for science, story and spirit. It's read by Margaret.
As I walk along a footpath on Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire, the early morning sky shifts from soft orange to bright blue. I weave my way through crowds of people who are singing and dancing towards the ancient pillars of Stonehenge that have stood here for thousands of years. Although we come from different viewpoints, from the spiritual to the scientific, we have aligned ourselves like the stones at the sunrise, waiting to hear the whispers of rock. As a geologist, rock speaks to me in a way that no other part of the natural world does. Each kind of rock reveals its own story through time, through its minerals and grains. Just as you can sense an artist's vision in brushstrokes of a painting, the structures and patterns in rock reveal and connect us to lives lived long ago. Along the beaches of Lyme Regis on Dorset's Jurassic coast, where I live, the grey limestones and shales tell the stories of the ancient sea that covered this landscape 200 million years ago. The cliffs spill their treasures onto the coast in the forms of fossils, revealing glimpses into a world which now only exists in our imagination. Granite in Cornwall forms much of its raw elemental coastline and eerie moors. Both have inspired legends of giants that have given the county's rock an almost enchanted character. At St. Michael's Mount, the giant Cormoran and his wife Cormelian are said to have quarried the mainland for granite to build the island. The bullion Cormoran discovered Cormelian carrying a lighter, more accessible greenstone instead and kicked her, causing the rock to spill from her apron to create the causeway that leads to the mount. On Bodmin Moor, another granite outcrop, the cheese ring, was said to be the site of a stone-throwing contest between giants and saints. The precariously balanced rocks left behind as proof of the battle. Around the world, many communities pass down stories that help explain the landscapes around them, from folklore and legends to ancestral tales. These narratives root people in place and time. In Indigenous contexts, however, storytelling often goes further still. The land itself is understood as animate, imbued with spirit and life, and the stories serve not only as memory, but as ongoing relationships with rock, river, and sky. While researching my book, I spent many months working with Indigenous communities, listening as people shared how their landscape connects them with their ancestors. The peaks in the Yosemite Valley are especially revered by Indigenous communities, particularly Half Dome, a 2,682-metre, that's 8,800-foot, granite peak, known by the Awanichi people as Tisiyak, the face of a young woman stained with tears. The peak is believed to once have been a woman who was turned to stone as punishment for quarrelling with her husband. Her story encourages her people to reflect on their own actions and be kind to one another. As a scientist and a Hindu, I find my dual identities help guide my understanding of the natural world through a broader lens than either would allow on its own. But in professional circles, that hasn't always been the case. As I developed my scientific self, I felt my cultural heritage and spirituality become a secondary and lesser identity. Lost and confused, I went in search of my dharti, the Hindu word which describes the grounding of oneself through soil, rock and land. Through embracing a sense of humility and empathy for the natural world, over time I found I could harmonize both sides of myself, the scientific and the spiritual. When I walked through the Stonehenge landscape for the celebrations, I felt an immense sense of kinship, not only with the people who surrounded me, but with the stones themselves. As I watched the sunrise peak through the outer circle, my experience resonated with my heritage, a migration story that stretches back over generations and can be traced from Rajasthan in India to Nairobi in Kenya, eventually ending in the UK where I was born. As I gazed at Stone 56, the tallest of the Sarsen stones, I understand how, although it is native to its Wiltshire landscape, it had travelled across time and space, as have all the stones here, some from nearby, others from as far as Wales. Between 65 and 23 million years ago, the area we now think of as the British Isles was a tropical paradise, submerged in warm turquoise seas and punctuated with isolated sandy islands. The sand eventually came together to form Stonehenge's Sarsen sandstones, which were scattered across the landscape, particularly in Wiltshire and on the edge of the Marlborough Downs, an area about 15 miles, 24 kilometres north of their location today. They were brought to the site about 4,500 years ago, where they became a centrepiece within a ceremonial landscape to welcome the winter and summer solstices. The story of Stonehenge is one of deep time, far beyond a human lifespan. If we choose to listen to what I like to think of as the whispers of rock, I believe they give us the power both to forge our own sense of belonging within our landscape and to remind us that we exist within a global community that has evolved since the dawn of time. Rocks like those at Stonehenge, Avebury and further afield all hold significance beyond their geological origins because humans have been given them meaning and purpose. The same is true of that pebble you picked up on a beach. While its origins might whisper of mountains rising, the memory of the day it caught your eye and the emotions that evokes are just as powerful.
Did you know that Winnie the Pooh is now 100 years old? Happy birthday, Winnie. This is taken from the Coventry Evening Telegraph and is written by Daisy Box. It was A.A. Milne who introduced us to Winnie, and it would have been his 144th birthday in January. This is read by Elaine.
Winnie the Pooh, the bear of little brain but a big heart, is 100 years old. Author A.A. Milne created the story starring a teddy bear belonging to his son, Christopher. The bear had been bought at Harrods as a present for Christopher, who named him Edward. The bear was later renamed Winnie after a black bear at London Zoo, who had been the mascot of the Winnipeg Regiment of the Canadian Army. A.A. Milne and his wife Daphne would invent bedtime stories starring their son's soft toys, which as well as Pooh Bear included Piglet, who is nervous but very loyal and brave, Eeyore the donkey, who is renowned for being gloomy, while Bouncy Tigger is full of energy and enthusiasm. Fussy Rabbit, Wise Owl, Kind Kanga and Baby Roo join the adventures too. Young Christopher was the inspiration for the only human in the books, Christopher Robin. The lovable bear made his debut in a story in London Evening News in December 1925. The first book, Winnie the Pooh, was published in 1926 and followed by The House at Pooh Corner in 1928. A mixture of prose and verse, the first book has been translated into more than 50 languages, including a Latin version, in 1958. Christopher Robin and his bear appeared in A.A. Milne's poetry book, When We Were Very Young, in 1924, and again in Now We Are Six, in 1927. Cotchford Farm in Ashdown Forest, bought by Milne as a holiday home for his family in 1925, was the inspiration for the 100-acre wood where all of the adventures are set. Visit there today and you can find the iconic Pooh Sticks Bridge and the towering conifers around which Piglet and Pooh tracked the elusive heffalump. The illustrations for the books were created by E.H. Shepherd, who drew Pooh to look like a bear that belonged to his own son. Shepherd visited Ashdown Forest to draw the scenery firsthand, capturing the beauty of the woodlands and heath in his simple line drawings. Disney's first animated adaptation appeared in 1966, with Pooh being voiced by Sterling Holloway. It was Disney that gave Pooh his red shirt. Pooh and his friends are just as popular now as they were 100 years ago. Winnie the Pooh Day is celebrated on A.A. Milne's birthday, January the 18th, each year. Today, the original soft toys, including Winnie himself, are on display in New York Public Library. Many have tried to bring them back to the UK, even just for a visit, but they are so precious, no one has ever succeeded.
Another feature from the National Trust magazine now, Life on the Land. This is written by Fergus Collins and is read by Margaret.
It's not easy to break into farming. Land is expensive and rentals are increasingly hard to come by. So when the National Trust teamed up with Channel 4 to offer two of its farm tenancies in a new way, it was inundated with applicants. The farms on Trust Estate in Northumberland in 2023 and Airy, Snowdonia in 2024 respectively, each became the focus of a competition. Groups of prospective tenants were whittled down to 7 finalists, couples or solo entrants who then entered a 3-week intensive televised process filmed for Our Dream Farm, an 8-part Channel 4 TV series hosted by Matt Baker. Over the course of the show, the finalists proved their farming and business know-how and their understanding of how their farms fit into the local communities. Viewers shared in their triumphs and disasters, gained a better understanding of farming's unique joys and challenges, and shed tears as favourites were eliminated, until the winners emerged in a grand finale. As the successful couples waved goodbye to Matt as he left each farm for the final time, it felt like a perfect happy ever after ending, but in many ways it was just beginning. The first winners, Adam and Jenny Grieve and their 2 young children, became 10-year tenants of a farm on Wallington Estate in Northumberland. "I can't believe how quickly it's gone," says Jenny. "We've achieved so much in 2 years and have so much more planned." Their farm includes 136 hectares, 340 acres of grassland, woods and wetlands. "We're keen to make sure we get the balance right," says Adam. "The land needs to be productive so we can make a living off it. But by being nature friendly, we're making sure we repair the land, The more you put in, the more you get out. 2 years in, life is busier than ever, with Adam and Jenny juggling farm duties and family life alongside their off-site jobs. Adam is a livestock auctioneer, while Jenny works full-time for Northumberland Council. Until we're able to diversify and follow our business plan, the farm isn't itself an income, Jenny explains. We'd love to develop the holiday lets and set up school visits. We'll be able to do that once we're in a good financial position. The pair manage their livestock in a nature-friendly way. We intentionally plan to focus on sheep, says Adam, but we've since decided to shift the balance to include more cattle. Because cows and sheep graze in different ways, their combined effect produces an uneven mix of long and short grasses, allowing a variety of plants and insects to flourish. Managing the landscape is no mean feat, with wildflower meadows and newly restored peatland to care for. These areas are part of the Trust's wider efforts to re-wet the land and support biodiversity. These habitats require careful management, says Sally Richards, general manager at Wallington and one of the judges in Adam and Jenny's series. As they've been settling in, they've been working closely with the Trust and Natural England specialists to find the right balance between farming and nature. While the Greaves forge their path in Northumberland, hundreds of miles away, the other winning couple is facing a very different landscape, albeit with many of the same joys and challenges. As native Welsh speakers living in Airy, Sarah Jenkins and Jan Jones have slotted easily into life on their 240-hectare, 600-acre farm, Lindy Isaf. Their sheep have prospered, and like the Greaves, they have expanded their cattle herd to help with conserving the grassland. We're really lucky. We live in a beautiful part of the country, says Sarah. We've learned a lot and really enjoyed it so far. Alongside running their own farm, Johan is a part-time plumber and Sarah works as a shepherd on another farm. They've spent the first year of their 15-year-old tenancy getting to know the land. You can't use a quad bike here because the land is so rough and uneven, says Sarah. You have to round up the sheep on foot. Fortunately, their first spring and summer were warm and dry. The rest of the country was suffering with drought, but we couldn't have asked for better conditions, said Sarah. It was sunny, but we still had enough rain. These days, Lindy Isaf might no longer be able to generate its entire income from sheep farming. It has fewer livestock and there's less of a market for wool. But there are other ways to help farming pay. For many, agritourism, inviting visitors to a farm for leisure, education and a taste of family life, is becoming a key strategy. Sarah and Yuan have already made progress with diversifying their farm's income by renovating two bothies for tourists. We've moved into the annex, which was previously a holiday cottage, and have rented out the main farmhouse to visitors instead, as it offers far greater income, says Yuan. He also made use of the outbuildings for storage and as a workshop to build up his plumbing business. Many farms are offering tourist accommodation, hosting school visits, renting out farm buildings to other businesses, or even generating renewable power from wind and solar. Sally Richards agrees that when it comes to farming today, it's all about hedging your bets. Building a business with a few different income streams helps farms stay steady in the long run and cope with changes in the economy and environment, she says. Both couples must balance food production with nature conservation, and new farming schemes are reshaping how farmers are paid. The Trust General Manager of Airy, Tristan Edwards, hopes that Jan and Sarah might benefit from the new sustainable farming scheme in Wales, introduced in early 2025 as part of post-Brexit farming reforms. The scheme offers payment to farmers for managing their land for nature and public goods, such as clean water and good soil health. For decades, grants and subsidies were geared towards production, Tristan explains. Now the focus has shifted towards nature recovery and providing public goods, and some see that as a challenge to the way they farm. As the sustainable farming scheme gets underway, Tristan is hopeful it will become clearer that nature is an asset and a tool for farming. Organisations such as the Soil Association have demonstrated how improving the organic content of soil and encouraging natural pest predators such as ladybirds and ground beetles rather than pesticides leads to healthier crops and fewer losses. This approach also means farmers need to spend less on expensive fertilisers and other chemicals, and by increasing the tree cover on a farm, a practice known as agroforestry, they can provide shelter for livestock alongside protection for crops and soil from the ever more extreme weather caused by climate change.
Now, Robert Franklin talks to RNIB Connect about useful travel tips.
I'm delighted to be joined now by Robert Franklin. Robert's keen to talk about independent travel and also journey care, which has made a massive difference to his life. So thanks very much for joining us, Robert. Can you tell us a bit about your sight loss, please?
Yeah, I've had cataracts from the age of two. I've had five operations on my eyes. Then I had three laser treatments in the 90s. Then I had glaucoma in 2008. And a myopic macular sclerosis in 2016.
It's a lifetime of eye trauma. You've been through the mill with that, Robert.
Well, I have, but it's about getting on with it.
And you wanted to talk about travel and getting on with it, to let blind people know some of the options that are available to them and to help them get around. You've had a lot of support over the years from RNIB, and it was they who put you in contact with Access to Work. You didn't know about this, but they would be able to pay for your taxis to and from work.
Yes, they did. It was a relief, really, because once my sight got worse, they didn't want me to walk in the dark.
It was the local Sainsbury's, wasn't it? How far away from your house was it?
About half an hour walk.
And you were 30 years in Sainsbury's, Robert?
Well, over 30 years, yeah, 30 years on trolleys.
You must have enjoyed it.
I did at the time, yes.
Good for the fitness as well.
It was, yes. It saved going to the gym.
Definitely. And that option is open to anyone that's blind or partially sighted. They can get in touch with Access to Work and inquire about help with their own travel to and from work.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Although I only had it in the winter, that was enough for me from October to May, really. And then I used to walk to work then.
How much sight did you have at that point?
Well, my macular isn't as bad because it's more blurred vision than it is wet and dry.
And you've also done a lot of travelling around the country on buses and trains as well. And when you're travelling on trains, you phone ahead to the train station and they can arrange for people to come and help you navigate busy platforms and get on and off trains.
Well, journey care, I never knew anything about it until I went to Tynmouth back in 2016. And they saw me with my cane and they said to me, "You can get journey care." And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Well, we'll give you the number." So away I went.
So you book it before you leave the house, and then you have to be at the desk
24 hours before you're due to go.
Okay. And then you turn up half an hour early, and someone's there to meet you, and they give you a hand onto the train?
Yeah. And put you on the train, put your case on the train, and then someone comes and calls you when you get to your stop and puts you onto the next train.
That must be a godsend, especially when the train station's really busy.
Yes.
And it runs pretty smoothly, does it, most of the time?
Oh, brilliant. It's brilliant, yeah.
And also getting out the house, Robert, it's great for mental health and your fitness as well.
It is, yes. I'd say a lot of walking as well, which I do enjoy, and you're meeting different people.
Definitely, yeah, we're big on mental health at the radio station and always trying to encourage people with sight loss to get out there, be active and try and meet people, because it's so good for your fitness, but B, your mental health as well.
Yeah, and you're always talking to different people on the train as well. you get into a conversation, which I do, it's nice.
Now, you're also a member of a few clubs and you're involved with charities as well. You're a busy man. Can you talk about some of the things you're involved in?
Well, I've always been involved with Warwickshire Vision over the years. I've done a talk at the Monday Club at the Resource Centre in Coventry, Elston. And since I've had macula, I go to a macula group in Coventry, and all clubs are really, really nice people. They're all helpers and everybody.
What advice would you give to anyone listening that maybe feels a bit isolated themselves, or they haven't took advantage of some of the things that are on offer to help you get around?
Well, the thing is not to isolate yourself. Always best to go out and not sit around looking at four walls all day.
And what does the future hold for you?
Well, I don't know, really. I've never thought of that at the moment. But
just take each day as it comes, day at a time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And will you be doing more travelling, though?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Robert, it's been brilliant talking to you. Thanks very much for coming on and sharing your story with us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you.
And those tips bring us to the end of this week's edition. So it's goodbye from me and everyone here at Outlook. Bye-bye.